Ben was 27 for 46, and he was the leading rusher, chalking up only 20 yards. The forecast from the National Weather Service, we do have a slight chance of some showers and storms this morning. Right now, a broad area of heavy rainfall is moving through eastern Wisconsin. Some of that activity could dip into the WGTD listening area. At this point, though, it doesn't exactly look like that's a sure bet. It will be warm today, a high of 85. The normal high is 72. Tomorrow, a chance of some more showers and storms, a high of 77. Right now, 65. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really pleased that I can spend today's morning show with a former faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, Dr. William Kuhn, who was on the history faculty at Carthage from 1993 to 2008. And he has gone on to a very successful career as a published author with a number of books to his credit, including a couple of very interesting books about Jackie Kennedy, including Reading Jackie, that looks at her years as a book editor towards the end of her life. And he has written a number of other books, including Prince Harry, Boy to Man, The Isabella Club, The Politics of Pleasure, Mrs. Queen Takes the Train. And he is an expert on all matters related to British royalty and the royal family. So I wanted to ask Professor Kuhn to join me on today's morning show to talk about the life and legacy of Queen Elizabeth II and, of course, the dramatic events which unfolded yesterday in London, watched by television viewers all around the world. So let's talk first about kind of the extraordinary events that unfolded yesterday, of course, and they came at the end of 10 days of official mourning throughout Great Britain. And maybe ahead of that, we should talk about the Queen's death and the fact that even though she was well into her 90s, this nevertheless was unexpected, in part because she had been seen just a couple of days before with the current prime minister and seemingly in good spirits and seemingly in at least decent health. And then came her death, which I think really added to the sense of shock for all of us.
Yes, I think you're right. Although she'd been having mobility issues for the last 6 months, and appearing with a cane, which was unusual for her, and for at least the last 6 months, maybe the last 9 months, Buckingham Palace was doing something very unusual, which was that they wouldn't confirm an event until the day of the event. Mm-hmm. So they were really waiting to see how she felt on the day itself. On whether to go ahead with things. And there was a Privy Council that should have been held immediately after Liz Truss was appointed Prime Minister, and that was going to be held via Zoom, so presumably it should have been an easy thing to do, and that was canceled. Hmm. So there were a few kind of mild signs that that things might have been getting a little worse for her. Hmm.
So she of course passes away. There is an outpouring of sorrow, really, from all corners of the globe, and I suspect you were not surprised by the scope of that outpouring of grief.
Well, I was a little bit, Greg. Hmm. I was. I don't know whether or not it's happened in your lifetime, but can you remember a time in your life when the American flag has been lowered for the death of a foreign leader?
No, I don't think so.
Well, I think, all the American flags that I've seen are at half-mast around here in Boston, Massachusetts. And I think that's for the Queen. I don't think that's for anything else. I don't think that's for COVID sufferers. I don't think that's for 9/11. I think that was for the Queen. So that surprised me. And then, the way that sort of Macron and Trudeau and others just came forward with very kind of quite eloquent and emotional statements about her, I think were indicative of the fact that, as you said, this is no longer the British monarchy. This is a kind of a global monarchy. And we know more about the late Queen's life even before she died, and we know more about Charles's life than we know about most of our politicians.
Hmm. Very true, isn't it?
So, now it's a global monarchy, and they talk a lot in Britain about soft power. The king doesn't have real power to appoint ministries. That's really all sewn up by the politicians. But as Prince of Wales, he's been pretty active his talking about climate issues, about environmental farming, about eating organic food and things which are untainted with chemicals. And so he's brought some attention, even though he doesn't have technical political power, he's brought some attention to those issues in a way that the monarchy can generally. And that's the kind of the soft, what the British call soft power that he has.
Interesting. We're speaking with William Kuhn, former faculty member at Carthage College, part of the history faculty there, a published author many times over, and an expert on all matters related to British royalty. And we're about to talk about the dramatic events that many of us watched on television yesterday with the funeral and committal service of Queen Elizabeth II. One of the things that caught me by surprise was a commentator saying something to the effect that a funeral, I think I got this right, had not been held at Westminster Abbey in a couple of centuries. And I think we careless Americans tend not to pay sufficient attention to just which cathedral are we looking at right now. But I just kind of assumed that everything significant happened in Westminster Abbey. Tell us a little bit about the location of this funeral and maybe why it was there and the significance of that.
There is some moving back and forth between Westminster Abbey and St. Paul's Cathedral for memorable royal events. Diana and Charles were married in St. Paul's. The state funeral, I think I'm right in saying this, but the state funeral for Winston Churchill, I think, was held at St. Paul's rather than the Abbey. I think the choice of the Abbey was really about some of the connections that the Queen had there. She was married there. There had been a funeral for her husband there fairly recently. And I think in that connection, the Abbey because she was also crowned there, the Abbey is a particularly important church for the monarchy. I'm just trying to think as I talk to you now where Queen Victoria's funeral was, and I think that was the Abbey too. So I think it's within precedent to have a London funeral at one of those two cathedrals. It can shift back and forth a bit. And to be quite honest, Greg, I'm going to do something with you that I should have done more often in front of the class, which is to say I just don't know about that.
Nothing wrong with that. Absolutely nothing wrong with that.
I'll give 5 extra points to the person who will bring that information into class tomorrow.
So tell us whatever you understand about how these kind of things are put together and who ends up making decisions about who will speak and who will sit where, and just kind of the framework of a service like this. I assume that we are talking about deep-seated traditions and protocols that are followed quite scrupulously, I should think.
Well, yes, and there's a kind of interesting backstory to this. The Duke of Norfolk is the hereditary Earl Marshal, and the Earl Marshal has in his hereditary portfolio, in addition to land and castles and urban wealth in London, the right to plan state funerals and the right to plan coronations. He also has a group of people who owe allegiance to him, who are in the College of Arms, who are all the heralds. They're kind of genealogists who will do your pedigree for you. But they also are kind of guardians of the Queen's titles and preserve the historical records about her titles. You can oftentimes find heralds in Shakespeare, for example, and there they go back and forth between enemy camps carrying messages. But in the modern period, they're genealogists. So the heralds and the Earl Marshal are the people to whom, hereditarily, speaking from a hereditary standpoint, have the right to plan these funerals. In fact, there's really a kind of a supervisory and ceremonial role, and the people who will really plan it are in the Lord Chamberlain's office. And the Lord Chamberlain is somebody who is appointed by the sovereign. And in the 19th century, these were hereditary aristocrats. In the modern period, they tend to be people who have had a distinguished career elsewhere. So the modern Lord Chamberlain used to be the head of MI5. This is a kind of a distinguished retirement job for him. So he's the equivalent of the head of the FBI. It's his office that has the plans, where the plans are really made, and in consultation with the sovereign, both Queen Elizabeth before she died and King Charles III, in consultation with them, the Lord Chamberlain plans the funeral. But it will have also been approved by political leaders, so that it all would have been shown to Liz Truss, and it would have been written down a long time ago, because the Queen got to a great age, and so they dusted off the plans every once in a while, just like, you know, the New York Times dusting off an obituary of a living person, and they would revisit them every once in a while. So the plans for this were in the books or in a safe digital file quite some time ago.
Among the striking images, of course, was not only of the new King Charles and his wife Camilla Bowes, and the other children of Queen Elizabeth, but of course the two sons of now King Charles present not only for the funeral, but also making a very dramatic appearance a few days ago during the period of mourning. That is William and Harry both. Share with us, please, your reaction to that dramatic moment when we saw both the sons of Charles appearing in public with their wives, something that was a profound and welcome surprise for many.
I think it was, and it was a moment where the Queen's death was being used as a way to build a bridge between two brothers who haven't been getting along recently, and that's a moving thing right there. Harry and Meghan have been seen, especially in Britain, although not so much in the States, to have attacked the Queen. And their statements about racism in the royal family and people not caring about their mental health have been perceived in Britain as a kind of a direct assault on the Queen. And their popularity is much lower there, I would say, than it is in the, than it is in the States. So to see the four of them together, who for a short time after their marriage were called the Fab Four, you know, after the Beatles, was a, sort of a heartening thing. I've also heard that there had to, that their appearance was slowed down because there had to be 45 minutes of negotiation before they actually appeared, which is not so nice. And The Guardian, which is a, which is probably the weightiest newspaper of record in Britain right now, which is the equivalent, let's say, of the New York Times or something like that, and which is a very anti-monarchical paper. They're openly Republican. They're, you know, they're in favor of the abolition of the monarchy. They gave front page news to William and Harry and say, in an article sort of saying there's a truce between them, but it's still a little bit shaky.
Among the other striking images in terms of people present for yesterday's funeral was the fact that, I believe this is true, every prime minister, current and past, who was living, was there at the funeral. Was that to be fully expected, or was that to any extent, do you think, a surprise?
No, that was to be fully expected. All current and past political leaders generally come to these events. And there's a tradition of, this may sound kind of ironic, but there's a tradition going back into the 19th century of trying to make big royal ceremonies representative. In other words, trying to make through the congregation an attempt to acknowledge all the different constituencies, both in Britain and around the world, that have some links to the royal family, whether that be via diplomacy. That is, Biden was there because we have a long-term diplomatic relationship with the British, or whether or not they're heads of Commonwealth governments like the Canadians and the Australians, or more recently, whether or not they represent some of the charities that the royal family gives its time to. So there's an attempt not to make not to make the ceremony democratic, but it uses one of the principles of democratic government, which is that all constituencies within a political nation ought to be represented at key moments. And that's something which is, you know, which we think of about the British Parliament, but it's also something they've tried to reproduce in the congregations for these ceremonies.
I was struck by the fact that a number of the people who participated in the service were women. And I mean, I only found it remarkable in the sense that the last time there would have been a state funeral for a monarch, which would, of course, been Queen Elizabeth's father, chances are there would have been nobody up front who was a woman, or for that matter, probably a person of color. And there was a sense of inclusiveness in terms of who were at least some of the participants of the service.
No, I was impressed by that too. It's a much more diverse population inside the Abbey. It was yesterday than we would have seen in 1952 when her father died. I think that's that's characteristic and emblematic of politics in the States as well as in Britain. You know, women and people of color are much more part of the political nation than they were at the beginning of her reign, and that's kind of a heartening thing. Baroness Scotland, who is the head of the Commonwealth, and whose parents were Dominican. I mean, she's British, but her parents, I think, were Dominican. Read the first lesson, and she read it eloquently, and I loved seeing her up there.
Mm. Any other striking moments from the funeral itself that you remember especially vividly?
Well, it was a little bit of a shock to see Earl Spencer in the congregation at St. George's. I mean, he's famous for having stood up at Diana's wedding and for having lashed out at the royal family. And the Queen was sitting there and present and had no way of answering him. So he certainly did something which she would have regarded as unforgivable. But he's also the uncle of the heir to the throne. So I think he was included on that front. He was also just, you know, he's been on Twitter promoting himself and showing the cufflinks with the Queen's sign manual, which he wore yesterday, and talking about his father's connection to the Queen. All of which are, I think, true, but I'd call that a little sketchy myself.
Mm. A little unfortunate.
Yes. Yes.
The funeral, of course, was followed by a dramatic procession outdoors, and eventually they end up at the committal service. And this was... if I understand correctly, the first time that that a committal service has been shared with the public on television. And of course, again, at the time of Queen Elizabeth's father's death, I mean, the idea of televising anything was still pretty dramatic and groundbreaking. I mean, as for instance, the televising of her coronation was quite unprecedented. But so I guess it shouldn't be a surprise, but nevertheless, I felt so grateful that the decision was made for the committal service at St. George's Chapel to be telecast and shared with the world, because I thought it was especially poignant and also tremendously interesting.
It was. I mean, and very dramatic, that moment when her coffin started descending into the floor. I mean, you couldn't come up with a more dramatic moment than that. So, yes, I love that, too. Her coronation was televised, but only after furious arguments. And the person who was most powerful about arguing in favor of television was the Duke of Edinburgh, who was then young and a firebrand and wanted to break with the precedent that this should not have, at some point, they didn't even want still pictures in there. But he said this should be televised, and he won. And I think there's been a kind of an increasing move toward transparency in the monarchy. They published annual figures about their expenditures and the amount of money that they get from the government, the amount of money they get from proceeds of letting tourists into Buckingham Palace. That never used to be the case. And there seems to be increasing transparency, increasing ability to see what were formerly private ceremonies going on as well. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to somebody who was kind of the 19th century apostle of the British monarchy. He was somebody who really kind of sketched out the theory and the practice. And he was not a royal figure. He was then the editor of The Economist. His name was Walter Bagehot. And he said, with the British monarchy, its visibility is its life. Because it doesn't exist to exercise power. It doesn't exist to send people to war. It exists to solemnize in a kind of a public way, public occasions, and to give those times a sense of occasion by their presence. And so that's why he was saying visibility is so important to the monarchy.
I wonder if you could just say a word about that especially dramatic moment just ahead of the coffin descending into the floor when those priceless objects on top of the coffin were very carefully, painstakingly removed and ultimately brought to the altar. And I'm talking about the orb and scepter and crown that had all been part of her coronation so many years ago, 70 plus years ago. Tell us more about those particular objects and symbolically what was happening in that moment.
Well, they're taking away from her the regalia, the symbols of her power, her significance, her importance, which were given to her by the Archbishop of Canterbury in 1953 in exchange for a promise that she will rule according to parliamentary laws, and she will rule with the consent of the British people. So those things aren't hers by right automatically. She has to give a declaration. She has to give that declaration at the coronation. And at that moment, now that she's died, they go back to the Tower of London, and they won't be given to Charles until his coronation, which is likely to be next year sometime. And he will have to make a similar promise. Because although the right to be king sort of descends in a kind of a hereditary way, it goes with this promise to live according to the rule of law. And that really kind of, that's really the meaning of constitutional monarchy. It's rule by consent of the people. And I think that's a dimension of royal life that is not often kind of visibly seen, but that's what was being represented when those, that regalia was being taken away from her after death and put on the altar. I have to say that I really agreed with you that I was holding my breath during that stuff. And I was, you know, I was watching as the stuff was being passed to the two guys who, I can't really tell you who what officials they were, but they, then the two officials gave the regalia to the Dean of Windsor to put on the altar. And I was just watching them, and there was eye contact between them. Have you got it? Yes, I've got it. Are you sure you've got it? Are you going to drop it?
Yes.
No. That whole moment, I was holding my breath during that stuff.
As was I. I read someplace that at least one of the people involved in that transfer was the crown jeweler. Somebody entrusted with the upkeep of those. And do you happen to know, in terms of those actual objects, that actual orb, that scepter, that crown, are we talking about objects that stretch back into history? I mean, like, for instance, are any of those the objects that would have been held and worn by, for instance, Queen Victoria?
No. They're kind of remade to fit individual heads, and Queen Victoria had a smaller crown. What carries on are individual jewels in them. So there's a very big ruby that goes back to crowns of medieval kings.
Wow.
And a very big diamond, likewise, which has been in the crown for centuries. And so it it tends to be the individual jewels in it which are historical rather than the crown itself.
At any rate, it felt, I wonder if you agree, it felt so right to begin with the huge state funeral at Westminster Abbey, thousands in attendance, to this much smaller, more intimate, more personal sort of service in a place much more frequently visited by the Queen during her life. And it just seemed like a very natural progression. And, of course, ultimately the burial service itself, which I think was just the family itself, it seems like that was a natural and lovely progression for the events to take.
Yes, that last service at 7 o'clock wasn't televised, and there were no reporters there. So, yes, it was a progression from the very formal in the Abbey to Windsor Castle. That they specifically chose what in the British call A roads, which are not motorways, to get the hearse to Windsor so that it could be seen by more people. The most direct way to Windsor is to get on the M4 motorway from London. And, you know, a lot of people will have been on that motorway, maybe who are listening here. But, I mean, when you get on that motorway and you're going to Heathrow, the castle is right on the left. And it's up on a big hill and you can't miss it. And it's kind of awe-inspiring. They specifically didn't take the fastest way. They took more minor roads to lengthen the procession so that more people could see it before it actually got to Windsor.
Wow. We're speaking with William Kuhn, former member of the history faculty at Carthage College and an expert on matters related to British royalty and the royal family. And we're talking, of course, about yesterday's dramatic events with the state funeral of Queen Elizabeth II. And we are going to talk for the next few minutes about her life and legacy and about the life and legacy of her son, the new king, King Charles III. So among the many superlatives shared about Queen Elizabeth II, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe she had the longest reign of any monarch in history, or at least in modern history. So there is much more to her legacy than longevity, but in a sense, that extraordinary longevity of reign is probably something we should not take for granted and really need to stop and sort of fully and deeply appreciate.
Well, you're absolutely right. It is the longest reign in British history. The two long reigns that came before it were Queen Victoria's in the 19th century and George III's, the king who we fought against in the American Revolution. But she outlasted both of them. It's hard to imagine not putting a foot wrong during 70 years on the throne. You're in such a spotlight. And it seems to me that politicians, they're in office for 2, 3, 4 years, and already there's some sort of scandal brewing about something that they've done wrong. And although there were scandals associated with her family, she was, for the most part, untouched by them. Yes, they, you know, temporarily affected monarchical popularity or unpopularity, but there's no way that you can kind of point to her relationship with one prime minister or the other and sort of say she really showed her political hand there and she shouldn't have done that, or she really obstructed this bill and that was a mistake. You can't say that about her. And so that negative is really kind of a positive about her reign.
I wanted to share something that I remember from a really marvelous documentary from some years ago called The Windsors that took a long view of the entire family. And it was beautifully done, in my opinion. And One of the persons interviewed that we hear from was, I think it's Lady Pamela Hicks, who was, I think, Queen Elizabeth's lady-in-waiting for a time, I think a bridesmaid at her wedding. And at one point, she says something so eloquent. She says something to the effect of, I think a lot of people think, to be queen, what fun to be queen. And then she just kind of pauses and, yes, you know, perhaps for a day, but for a lifetime. And it's just that idea that there is a certain load of responsibility that is part of being queen, and to shoulder that responsibility and to do so for so many years through the course of a changing world. And I really thought that was striking. I have never forgotten those words, and it, for me, helps me appreciate the legacy of Queen Elizabeth.
Well, I think there's both a negative and a positive to be said about that. The negative is that one of the things that Harry did that people are so angry with him about in the royal family is less the accusation of racism than his saying publicly, nobody wants this job, and I don't want it, my brother doesn't want it, my father doesn't want it. And he's saying something which is quietly true, but which they agree never to say out loud. The reason why nobody wants this job is that there's a lot of self-denial involved. You can't be, generally speaking, and this is, I think the Queen has in many ways solidified something which was a tradition before, but she's given it additional weight, is you can't have lots of political opinions. You can't have political favorites. You can't show your political views. And that's some self-denial involved in that, because that's part of all of our personalities, to be able to express our views on what's going on. And she, for the most part, did not do that.
What would you have people know or understand about the duties and responsibilities of the Queen, aside from what you were just saying about, in a sense, placing the good of the British people above, you know, one's own personal concerns? Help us understand her significance, the role that she played.
Well, the daily job can be, I think, quite challenging, because she's going off to all sorts of kind of small provincial places in a country which is not a lot bigger than Wisconsin. And she's seeing a factory be opened. She's giving some attention to a local Boy Scout troop. She's doing lots of things. She's things with civic authorities in pretty small towns. She is meeting diplomats on a daily basis, and she is seeing members of the armed services. So she gets to meet the people who are at the very highest part levels of government, but she's confined in her conversations with them to discussions about the weather. it's not always that bad. And, you know, she found a lot of room for making jokes and for connecting with people on a personal level. But she can't say, you know, what do you think of X? What do you think of Y politicians who are causing all the headlines in the newspapers at the moment?
So it's intriguing to think, we tend to think about someone like the Queen of England as having nearly limitless, not exactly power, but I mean, a sovereign figure telling everybody else, in a sense, what to do. I mean, that's just kind of a careless summary. And of course, in so many respects, the British monarch is very tightly constrained by various kinds of responsibilities and duties and protocols. And And that's the kind of thing that we here in the United States certainly don't tend to understand very well.
No, we think of them in satin sheets. We think of them riding around in Rolls Royces. We don't think of her, you know, looking at her watch in Barry St. Edmunds at breakfast and sort of say, God, I've got to be in Birmingham at lunch. And who are they going to put me next to and what are we going to talk about? And then I've got to be here at 3 p.m. and I'm not going to be able to kick off my shoes until 7 p.m. when we get back to London.
So let's talk about her son, who is the new king, of course, King Charles III. And one of the things, of course, that is so striking about the difference between the two of them is how young Elizabeth was when she became queen and how old Charles is now, assuming the throne as king. And you know, that has to be two, you know, nearly world record breaking milestones in terms of how Queen Elizabeth's reign began and King Charles's reign, how it begins in terms of the time of life, the sense of preparation for it, and so on. Draw that contrast for us, please.
Well, she was 25 when she came to the throne. It was a time of real austerity in Britain following the Second World War. Her father died in 1952. I was actually conceived in England in 1956 because my father was there on a sabbatical. And in 1956, which was more than 10 years after the end of the war, my parents remembered how much London was still affected by rationing, how many bomb sites were not repaired, how gray London was even in the mid-1950s, long after the states had really begun to recover from the war. So her coming to the throne, age 25, was a moment of kind of glitz and glamour that really was a contrast with the austere post-war Britain. Charles is in his 70s. I think he's 73. And he's coming to the throne in the midst of a different crisis. There's a kind of a, I'd say there's a sort of a gathering sense globally that climate change is out of control and we may not be able to get in front of it. And he has been an eloquent speaker on behalf of climate issues, which are perhaps becoming less political now and more universal as a topic of concern. He's also, a different person than his mother, much more emotional. And I think you could see his evident sadness yesterday in the services. He's more interested in culture and the arts. He goes regularly to the opera. He had Dame Kiri Tikanawa sing at his wedding. That's not the kind of thing that the Queen took much interest in. So as somebody who's interested in the arts himself, i.e. me, I kind of like that about Charles. I think he's likely to lead a more slimmed down monarchy. In other words, fewer people on the balcony, more emphasis on the king's role as head of state, and less emphasis on the social occasions. I don't even know whether or not he'll carry on with his mother's tradition of horse racing, which is a pretty difficult thing to carry on in an egalitarian era because it's such an expensive hobby. And the Queen got away with it. Jackie Kennedy got away with it. But I'm not sure Charles will want to go forward with that. And that's more the kind of the social end of the monarchy rather than the head of state role, which has traditionally been about receiving foreign visitors, convening heads of charities, that kind of thing.
I was struck by his televised comments to the world after his mother's death. I thought they were beautifully phrased and delivered. And I was also struck by the momentary mention he made of Harry and Meghan, and the way in which he framed some of the choices that they have made about their own lives. I wonder if you would agree with that.
Oh, completely. He said, I want to mention Harry and Meghan starting out their own lives in America. And, you know, this is a completely new phase for them. And I love them both. I don't think the Queen ever said, I love, in an official statement during the whole of her reign. She probably promised to cherish, love and cherish Philip at her wedding ceremony. But in a kind of a statement where she's kind of speaking to the camera, which was her annual Christmas talk, I don't think she ever said, I love you to anybody. So that was different. It also kind of cuts the legs out from under Harry and Meghan, because Harry's supposed to be publishing a tell-all memoir quite soon in which he says disobliging things about the royal family. And if I were him or I was the lawyer who was advising them, I'd just sort of say, you know, return the advance. Do not bring this book out. It's going to make you look very foolish, and the media are going to jump on it as a kind of a controversy, and it's not going to benefit anybody.
Mm. What about the role that Harry's brother, Prince William, plays from this point on, and what kind of figure do you see? What kind of role do you see him playing as we go forward from here?
Well, he's going to play a much more prominent role. He's the number two now. He was number three before, so he's going to be in the spotlight more. My sense about William, I don't know him. I've never met him. I don't know any of his friends. But my sense is that when I see him, I see him suffering to a degree in the way that his father did from the limelight. I don't think he's yet come into an enjoyment of his role that Charles started having after he married Camilla, and which the current queen didn't exactly enjoy her role, but she was comfortable in it, and you never saw her suffering in it. William looks to me sometimes with his lowered eyebrows as if this is hard work that he's doing, and I don't blame him. He lost his mother at a very young age, and there have been a lot of controversies that he's had to cope with.
Mm.
The one time that I have recently seen, and, you know, Greg, you can just sort of say, Bill, you're such a royal sop. I'm not going to believe you on this. But the one time that I have seen him looking natural was that right after the Platinum Jubilee services, he started selling The Big Issue, you know, the magazine which helps homeless people, on the street corner in London. And he did this for about, I don't know, 3 days in a row. And he looked so happy and so natural in that role that I hope he gets to do more of it.
William Kuhn, former history faculty member at the University at Carthage College and a published author many times over. My thanks to Professor Kuhn for joining me today on The Morning Show. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll be previewing the current production at the Racine Theatre Guild, which is a wonderful new play called Native Gardens, and we'll also be talking with the author of a brand new book called The Magus Conspiracy, which is a book written to fit into the sprawling and complex universe of Assassin's Creed, one of the world's most popular video games. And on Thursday, we'll be talking with Dr. Joseph Benson from the University of Wisconsin Parkside about the current season of the foreign film series at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, one of the loveliest fixtures on the cultural landscape of southeastern Wisconsin. It's in, I believe, its 39th season, and they are back in the theater after a season that had to be virtual because of the COVID pandemic. We'll be talking with him about all of that